Welcome to Office Hours. I'm Sarah, and this is the first episode of a new run.
And I'm Kiffer. We're starting a brand new course today, the opening course in a sequence of four. Think of this one as the breadth course. Before students get deep into methods, statistics, study design, all the machinery, we wanted a term that just asks the big questions. What is health? What do we know about it? Whose answers count?
So this is lesson one, conceptualizing health, illness, and disease. And honestly, when I first saw the title, I thought, okay, that's a definitions lesson. We'll knock it out in an hour, but that's not really what the module does.
No, and I'd argue that's part of the point. The history of public health is in large part a history of arguments about what counts as health, what counts as illness, what counts as disease, and who has the standing to decide. The way a society answers those questions determines what gets measured, what gets treated, what gets ignored, and whose suffering counts.
That last bit is the one I want to circle back to a few times today. Whose suffering counts? Because depending on which definition you reach for, the answer changes.
It does. And the lesson opens with a really useful warning. The first reflex of a careful health scientist when somebody makes a claim about health is to ask which level of explanation that claim is operating at. We're going to spend the whole episode building that reflex.
Okay, let's start with the four words that ordinary speech uses interchangeably: disease, illness, sickness, and health. The lesson treats them as technically distinct.
Right. These distinctions come out of medical anthropology and sociology in the 1970s, particularly Arthur Kleinman at Harvard and the Welsh sociologist Anthony Twaddle. They've done a lot of work clarifying conversations that would otherwise just go in circles.
Walk us through them.
Disease is the biomedical category. It's a pathological state of the body that can, in principle, be diagnosed: a tumor on imaging, a virus on PCR, a fracture on X-ray. Disease lives in the body and in the diagnostic codes that describe it. The international classification, ICD-11, has something like 55,000 of those codes. Disease is what doctors treat. It's what hospital systems track. It's what ends up on a death certificate.
And illness?
Illness is the lived experience of being unwell. What the person feels and reports, the fatigue that won't lift, the pain that has no name, the worry that something is wrong. Illness is shaped by culture, language, family, biography. A person can have a disease without feeling ill. A symptomatic high blood pressure is a classic case, or an early asymptomatic COVID infection. And a person can feel deeply ill without any detectable disease. Medically unexplained symptoms account for something like 15 to 30% of primary care visits, depending on the survey.
That gap between disease and illness is huge, and we under-talk about it. The third one is sickness, which I always have to remind myself is its own category.
Sickness is the social role of being unwell. It's the institutional and relational response when somebody's recognized as ill. The sociologist Talcott Parsons called it the sick role back in 1951, a temporary suspension of normal obligations like work, school, family duties, conditional on the sick person seeking help and trying to recover. Sickness is what gets a doctor's note. It's what gets a workplace accommodation. It's what shows up in workers' compensation claims. Of the three, it's the most institutionally visible and the most directly governed by policy.
And the three really do come apart. Give us an example where they peel away from each other.
The classic one. A person with well-controlled HIV has a chronic disease. HIV infection is but no current illness. They feel fine, fully functional, and limited sickness role. They work full-time, no formal accommodations. So you have disease without illness, without sickness. The inverse is somebody on long-term sick leave with no clearly diagnosed condition. Lots of sickness role, lots of illness, contested disease.
And the practical work of public health is partly the work of asking which of the three is in play in any given moment.
Exactly. If you misread which of the three is at stake, you'll prescribe the wrong response.
Okay, so those three describe ways of being unwell. What about health itself?
The standard 20th century answer was negative. Health is the absence of disease. The standard contemporary answer, traceable to the WHO 1948 definition, is positive. Health is a state of being well that goes beyond merely not being sick. Both answers have problems. The negative one is operationally easy. You can measure absence of disease using clinical criteria, but it implies that somebody with no diagnosable condition is healthy regardless of how they feel or function, which is counterintuitive.
And the positive one?
Intuitively richer, but operationally hard. How do you measure a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being without dragging in every social problem in the world?
And the module flags a contemporary move that splits the difference. Machteld Huber, Dutch researcher.
Yeah, Huber defines health as the ability to adapt and self-manage in the face of social, physical, and emotional challenges. Notice what that does. It treats health as a capacity rather than a state. It admits that everyone faces challenges, and that being healthy means being able to respond to them, not being free of them.
Which lands really differently for chronic disease.
Massively. Because for most chronic conditions, the goal is no longer eliminate the condition. Often that's impossible. The goal is preserve function and adaptation. Huber's definition fits that reality.
And the choice between negative and positive matters concretely, not just philosophically. It changes what you measure.
Right. A negative definition health survey asks about diagnosed conditions and counts them. A positive definition survey asks how the person rates their own health, how they function, how they participate. Statistics Canada's Canadian Community Health Survey does both deliberately because the agency has learned over decades that the two approaches answer different questions.
Then the lesson introduces three cousins of health that are sometimes used interchangeably and sometimes mean really different things. Wellness, well-being, flourishing.
Three rungs of a ladder, basically. Wellness typically refers to behaviors that maintain or enhance health, nutrition, physical activity, sleep, stress management. The wellness industry, globally a $5 trillion commercial sector, is built on this idea. Wellness sits closest to the medical model. It tends to be individual, behavioral, and amenable to retail intervention, gym memberships, supplements, apps, and it's also the most criticized of the three because it can shade into offloading structural problems onto individuals.
Well-being is broader.
Well-being brings in subjective satisfaction with life, sense of meaning and purpose, social connection, material security. It draws on positive psychology, Martin Seligman's work, and on the UK Office for National Statistics Well-being Program that's been measuring four indicators across the UK population since 2011. And well-being measures correlate with health measures, but they're not the same. A person can have high well-being despite chronic illness. Somebody with diabetes who has strong relationships, satisfying work, a sense of purpose, or low well-being despite no detectable disease. Somebody who's lonely, anxious, disconnected.
And flourishing is the most ambitious.
It draws on Aristotle's eudaimonia, living well in the fullest sense. A flourishing person isn't just disease-free, they're actively thriving, contributing, learning, loving, growing. The Harvard Human Flourishing Program, led by the epidemiologist Tyler Vanderweele, has been measuring this across multiple countries since 2017. Whether flourishing-focused public health is operationally tractable is honestly still an open question. It's one of the active frontiers of the field.
Why do these distinctions actually matter for everything that follows? Because a student could reasonably say, okay, fine, word games.
And the module gives three examples that recur through the course. The first is opioid use disorder. Whether opioid use disorder is treated as a disease, clinical condition with a biological mechanism treatable with medication, or as an illness, the lived experience of dependency and craving, or as a sickness, a social role that produces specific institutional responses like methadone clinics or supervised consumption sites or criminal justice involvement. That choice determines what gets funded, who is in charge, and what counts as success. The same person with the same condition gets very different responses depending on which framing wins.
Second example.
ME/CFS, myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, and now long COVID. For decades, chronic fatigue syndrome was illness without disease. Patients described profound symptoms. No biomedical signature was found. The community of patients fought for decades to have it recognized as a disease with limited success until long COVID, which is biomedically similar in many cases, gave the older syndrome new visibility.
And the gap there has concrete consequences. Insurance, disability benefits, research funding.
Clinician training, the whole thing.
Third one.
Maternal mental health. A mother experiencing postpartum depression is unambiguously ill. The experience is real and distressing. Whether she has a disease depends on how diagnostic criteria are written. Whether she occupies the sickness role depends on whether her family, employer, and healthcare system accommodate or stigmatize her condition. A lot of maternal mental health programs work specifically by activating the sickness role, by making it normal and supported for new mothers to admit they're struggling.
That's a really nice example of the categories doing different work. Quick aside, The module's method spotlight in the section is about self-rated health, the CCHS item. In general, would you say your health is excellent, very good, good, fair, or poor? And that one item turns out to be a serious predictor of mortality.
Eidler and Benyamini in 1997 did the foundational meta-analysis, 27 community studies. They showed self-rated health predicts mortality independently of physician-measured health. And the prediction holds across countries, decades, methodological approaches. The reason it works is partly that the respondent integrates everything they know about their own body and trajectory into one global judgment. It's a remarkable item.
Okay, so that's section one, the conceptual vocabulary. Section two walks us through the history. Five Western models of health, one after another.
And the point of the historical sweep, before we go through it, is that every model, including the current one, is provisional. 60 years from now, students will read about us the way we're about to read about the 1850s.
Humors, miasma, germ theory, biomedical, biopsychosocial start with humors.
The earliest sustained Western theory of health was the humoral theory, Hippocrates around 400 BCE, elaborated by Galen about 500 years later. Health was understood as a balance among four bodily humors: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, black bile, each one associated with a temperament, a season, an element. Disease was in balance, treatment was rebalancing, diet, exercise, climate, and when necessary, bloodletting, purging, cupping.
And the theory was wrong about pretty much everything specific?
Wrong in nearly every detail, and also extraordinarily productive. The Hippocratic tradition treated health as deeply environmental, where you lived, what you ate, the air you breathed, the company you kept. The Hippocratic text, airs, waters, places from the 5th century BCE is recognizable as a kind of proto-epidemiology. It took clinical observations seriously, recorded cases in detail, and explicitly refused to attribute disease to divine punishment. That was the radical move.
And humoral theory just persisted.
Roughly 2,000 years, it was the framework underlying medieval European medicine, Islamic medical traditions, where it was preserved and translated back into Europe, most lay medical practice in Europe and North America well into the 19th century. The American Civil War was fought with troops being treated by army surgeons, whose practice was still substantially humoral. Bloodletting didn't fully disappear from U.S. medical practice until the late 19th century. The language is still walking around in everyday English: sanguine, phlegmatic, melancholic.
Then miasma.
Miasma theory was the transition from humors to germ theory, roughly late 17th century through the 1880s. It held that disease was caused by miasma, foul-smelling air arising from decomposing organic matter, swamps, sewage, crowded urban environments. The theory was wrong, but it produced some of the largest public health gains in human history.
Because its policy implications happened to line up with what germ theory would later require.
Exactly the right framing. If foul air caused disease, the response was to clean up the sources, drain swamps, build sewers, remove garbage, ventilate buildings, separate housing from waste, regulate cemetery proximity to wells. All of those measures undertaken on miasmatic grounds dramatically reduced waterborne and airborne infectious diseases. Cholera, typhoid, typhus, dysentery, the 19th century European mortality decline, especially among children and the urban poor, is in large part a sanitary revolution story, driven by a theory that was wrong and it worked.
And the institutional skeleton of modern public health comes out of that period?
Edwin Chadwick is the signature figure. British social reformer, 1800 to 1890. His 1842 report on the sanitary condition of the laboring population is one of the great public health documents. He was, by every account, an unpleasant man. Colleagues described him as authoritarian and humorless. But the report drove the UK Public Health Act of 1848 and inspired sanitary movements across Europe and North America. The sanitary inspector, the medical officer of health, the municipal water department, those all traced to this period.
Then the paradigm shift, germ theory.
Second half of the 19th century, probably the single largest theoretical revolution in the history of medicine, Pasteur, Koch, Lister. We'll meet them in detail in a later lesson, but the conceptual shift is what matters here. Pasteur showed in the 1860s that microorganisms, not spontaneous generation, caused fermentation and disease. Koch identified the bacterial causes of anthrax in 1876, tuberculosis in 1882, cholera in 1884, and formulated Koch's postulates, the criteria a microorganism has to meet to be considered the cause of a specific disease. Lister applied germ theory to surgery, introduced carbolic acid antisepsis in 1867, and post-surgical mortality dropped dramatically.
And the conceptual shift isn't just bad air to bad microbes, it's a fundamental change in how disease is theorized.
Right. Each disease now has a specific cause. The same kind of investigation that identified Mycobacterium tuberculosis can in principle identify the cause of any other infectious disease. Specific causes imply specific cures, eventually antibiotics, and specific preventions, eventually vaccines. The diagnostic categories that organize modern medicine are descendants of this revolution.
But the lesson is careful to note one thing: germ theory didn't settle.
It didn't tell you where to intervene. You can attack tuberculosis by treating individual cases, clinical medicine, by improving housing and reducing crowding, social policy, or by developing and deploying a vaccine, population medicine. All three approaches require germ theory, but germ theory doesn't say which to fund. That question is political and economic, and it's been refought in every public health era since.
Then the 20th century pushes germ theory's logic into a fully articulated biomedical model.
A specific cause produces a specific disease, identifiable by clinical investigation, treatable by a specific intervention. The biomedical model produced extraordinary gains: infectious disease control, surgical care, cancer treatment, pharmacology. But its limits became visible as chronic diseases, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, depression, chronic pain, replaced infectious diseases as the dominant causes of mortality in industrialized countries.
And the decisive critique came from George Engel in 1977.
Psychiatrist, paper, and science, he proposed the biopsychosocial model. The argument was that disease in humans cannot be understood through biology alone. Psychological factors, stress, beliefs, behavior, and social factors, relationships, work, environment, economic position, participate causally in nearly every chronic condition. The biopsychosocial model is not anti-biomedical. It includes the biomedical, but it refuses to treat the biological as sufficient. It's now the dominant model in chronic disease research, primary care training, and modern public health curricula.
And 2 years later, an even more radical reframe.
Aaron Antonovsky, Israeli-American medical sociologist, his 1979 book, Health, Stress, and Coping. He was studying women who had survived Nazi concentration camps. And he asked why some of them, having endured almost unimaginable trauma, remained healthy in old age while others didn't. The standard biomedical question is what makes people sick, pathogenesis. Antonovsky's question was what keeps people well. He called it salutogenesis, from the Latin salus, health.
And his central construct was sense of coherence.
Whether a person experiences life as comprehensible, manageable, and meaningful. People with high sense of coherence tolerate stress better and stay healthier across a wide range of exposures. And salutogenesis is not a replacement for pathogenesis. Both are needed. But it's a profound reorientation. It directs attention to what produces health, not what produces disease. It explains why most people, most of the time, are not sick, despite living in environments full of pathogens and stressors and risk factors.
And modern positive health frameworks descend from this. The WHO Healthy Aging Framework as PHAC's Positive Mental Health Framework.
Yeah, all of those owe Antonovsky a debt.
A nice line from the module on this: contemporary public health uses all five models simultaneously, often without acknowledgement.
A modern tuberculosis program uses germ theory for the cause, the biomedical model for treatment, the biopsychosocial model for adherence support and addressing housing instability, and salutogenesis for community-based programs that build resilience. The skill of a modern practitioner is partly being able to choose the right model for the right question and to recognize when a colleague is using a different one. A lot of disputes that look substantive, should we focus on biology or social conditions, are actually disputes about which model to apply, with both sides correct within their own model.
Reading the model is the first move.
Reading the model is the first move.
Okay. Section 3 is about the documents that shaped 20th century public health, four of them between 1948 and 1986.
Yeah, and I want to flag, knowing these well lets you read almost any contemporary health policy document and immediately recognize whose intellectual tradition the authors are working in. So they're worth knowing in some detail. Signed in July 1946 by representatives of 61 countries. Entered into force on the 7th of April 1948. the date now marked annually as World Health Day. And the preamble has one sentence that's been quoted and contested ever since. Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity.
Why was that revolutionary?
Two reasons. First, it placed mental and social dimensions on explicit and equal footing with the physical. In 1948, that wasn't obvious. Modern psychiatry was barely two generations old. The social sciences were largely separate from medicine. The dominant biomedical model treated the mind and society as either subsidiary to or irrelevant to health. The WHO broke that frame. Second, it defined health positively as a state to be achieved, not just a deficit to be avoided. That positive framing is the conceptual ancestor of all subsequent health promotion thinking.
The critiques...
They're well known. Complete well-being is unachievable. Almost no one is fully well at any moment, so almost everyone is unhealthy, which is operationally absurd. It medicalizes ordinary human variation, stress, grief, the normal struggles of life. It offers no operational measurement strategy, what counts as social well-being, and it sets a standard that by being impossible can justify any expansion of health system jurisdiction.
Critiques are largely right, and yet...
And yet nearly 80 years later, no replacement definition has displaced it. Huber's 2011 reformulation has been influential, but hasn't been formally adopted by WHO. The WHO definition continues to be cited in every major contemporary health document. Partly inertia, partly something more substantive. The definition's expansiveness is what gives it political utility. It legitimizes health system intervention in mental health, social conditions, and well-being in a way that a narrower definition wouldn't.
Next, the Lalonde Report.
1974, probably the single most important national health policy document in Canadian history. The formal title is A New Perspective on the Health of Canadians, released over the signature of Marc Lalonde, who was then Minister of National Health and Welfare in the Trudeau senior government.
And the argument was...
Simple and, for its time, radical. Lalonde proposed that health is determined by four broad health fields: human biology, genetics, aging, biological systems, environment, physical and social, lifestyle, the behavioral choices people make, and healthcare organization, the structure and resourcing of medical services. His central claim was that further investment in the fourth field, at the healthcare system, would produce diminishing returns. Substantial gains in population health were still available, but they were going to come from investing in the first three.
Which was politically explosive.
It said in a government white paper, we've been investing in the wrong things. That kind of honesty about health spending is rare anywhere and was rarer in 1974. The report drove the creation of Canada's Health Promotion Directorate in 1978, the world's first national health promotion agency, and it inspired similar reframes in other countries. Arguably, the founding document of modern global health promotion.
The Lalonde lifestyle field has been criticized for individualizing health.
Yeah, and the criticism is fair. The lifestyle field can easily be read as putting too much weight on personal behavior and not enough on structural determinants. But the basic insight that healthcare is one determinant among several and not the largest has been confirmed by every serious analysis since.
And then Alma Ata, 1978.
4 years after Lalonde, WHO and UNICEF convened the International Conference on Primary Healthcare in Alma-Ata, modern Almaty, Kazakhstan, then in the Soviet Union, 6th to 12th of September, and the conference produced the Alma-Ata Declaration, a short, remarkable document. It did two things. First, it announced the goal of health for all by the year 2000, a deadline now famously missed, but at the time genuinely intended. The phrase was a moral commitment.
Every person in every country deserves access to a basic standard of health.
Right, and second, it placed primary healthcare at the center of global health policy, not specialized hospitals, not high technology medicine, but accessible community-based first contact care that addresses the most common conditions and supports prevention and education.
And the driving figure was Halfdan Mahler.
Director General of the WHO at the time, Danish public health physician. He'd spent years in India working on tuberculosis control and understood from firsthand experience why specialist-driven medical systems fail majority populations. Alma-Ata's argument was that 80% of a population's health needs can be met at the primary care level by a well-trained generalist, and that building that system would do more for global health than any number of high-end hospitals.
And the post-Alma-Ata story is complicated.
Health for all by 2000 wasn't achieved by 2000 or by 2025. And the original vision got watered down in the 80s by what was called selective primary health care, a more vertical disease-specific approach pushed by the World Bank and others. But Alma-Ata's framework remains the canonical reference point for primary healthcare globally. The 2018 Astana Declaration explicitly reaffirmed it in modern language. When Canadian advocates argue for stronger family medicine, community health centers, and universal access, they're arguing in the Alma-Ata tradition, whether they cite it or not.
And the fourth document was drafted in Canada.
Ottawa Charter for Health Promotion, November 17th through 21, 1986. WHO First International Conference on Health Promotion convened in Ottawa. The charter is short, fewer than 1,500 words, but it specifies five action areas that have organized health promotion practice ever since.
Walk us through them.
One, build healthy public policy, bring health considerations into all sectors of government policy, not just the health portfolio. Two, create supportive environments, shape the physical and social environments so that healthy choices are the default. Three, strengthen community action, support communities to set their own priorities and act. Four, develop personal skills, education and skill building that lets people take control of their own health. Five, reorient health services, shift the system from treatment focus to prevention and promotion focus.
And those five show up explicitly or implicitly in basically every Canadian health promotion strategy of the past 40 years.
Yeah, the Public Health Agency of Canada's strategic plans, BC's Healthy Families BC framework, Ontario's public health standards, all map onto Ottawa charter structure. And what makes the charter durable is its breadth. It refuses to locate health promotion in a single sector. Policy, environments, communities, individuals, services all share responsibility. That health in all policies instinct is one of the largest contributions Canadian public health has made to global thinking.
Okay, Section 4 is the one I want to spend some real time on. Pluralism, the non-Western frameworks.
And this is where the lesson does an important move. Everything in the first three sections has been a tour of Western intellectual traditions. The lesson is honest about that. They're not the only frameworks the world uses to think about health. And in Canada specifically, taking other frameworks seriously is no longer optional. It's a matter of scientific accuracy, ethical practice, and reconciliation.
The lesson focuses on three Indigenous holistic frameworks, with special attention to the medicine wheel, Te Wera Tapawa from Aotearoa, New Zealand, and the broader concept of cultural safety.
Start with Indigenous holistic models. Across North America, the frameworks vary significantly across nations, but several recurring features distinguish them from Western models. Health is typically conceptualized as a dynamic balance across multiple integrated dimensions, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual, none of which is primary. It's explicitly relational. A person's health is constituted in part by their relationships with family, community, ancestors, and land. And it's cyclical. Life stages, seasons, generations are constitutive of health, not external context.
The medicine wheel is a teaching tool that visualizes the integration.
It's one widely used teaching tool, and important to flag, there is no single pan-Indigenous medicine wheel. Teachings vary by nation, family, elder. In one common interpretation used in Plains Cree, Anishinaabe, and other traditions, the wheel is divided into four quadrants corresponding to the four directions, the four life stages, the four dimensions of person, and the four medicines, tobacco, sage, sweetgrass, cedar. Health is the dynamic integration of all four quadrants. Illness is imbalance.
And what's operationally distinctive from a public health perspective is what the framework does with land.
That's the key move. The Western biopsychosocial model treats land as either irrelevant or as an environmental exposure, water quality, air quality. The medicine wheel treats a person disconnected from their land as by that fact less healthy. That's not a metaphor. It generates testable predictions. Land-based programs should improve health. Cultural revitalization should improve health. Language reclamation should improve health. And all three have substantial empirical support in the contemporary Indigenous public health literature.
The First Nations Health Authority in BC has built around this.
Established in 2013 as the first Indigenous-controlled provincial health authority in Canada, it integrates medicine wheel-style frameworks into operations. The FNHA's First Nations perspective on health and wellness puts the individual at the center of nested circles, mental, emotional, spiritual, physical, then social, cultural, economic, environmental, that mirror medicine wheel structure. Operational, not symbolic. Clinical guidelines, evaluation frameworks, funding decisions all organize around it.
to wear Tapawa.
Aotearoa New Zealand produced one of the most influential non-Western health frameworks of the past 40 years. The phrase translates as the four-walled house, articulated by the Maori physician and academic Mason Durie in the early 80s. Adopted across the New Zealand health system, the framework treats health as a house with four walls: taha tinana, physical health; taha hinangaro, mental and emotional health; taha wanao, family and social health; taha wairua, spiritual health. All four walls necessary. Remove one, the structure collapses.
And it does in a Maori frame what the biopsychosocial model does in a Western frame, with one key addition.
The explicit centrality of wanao, extended family and community, and wairua, spiritual dimension, both more central than they are in the biopsychosocial model. And the framework has been operationalized in New Zealand healthcare delivery, mental health practice, education, social services, formally adopted by the New Zealand Ministry of Health, taught in medical and nursing schools.
And the lesson flags an important contrast with Indigenous Canadian frameworks. SIP.
Yeah, worth being precise about. To wear tapawa is a single coherent framework articulated by a specific scholar from a specific Indigenous tradition. Mason Durie's writings provide a canonical text. Indigenous Canadian frameworks vary across nations, and there's no single canonical statement, which is itself a reflection of the diversity of Indigenous nations in Canada. Both situations are legitimate. Treating one as a model for the other can be a mistake.
But then cultural safety.
Coined by Irihapedi Ramsden, a Maori nurse, in the early 1990s in the context of New Zealand nursing education. Cultural safety has been adopted in Canadian Indigenous health work, especially through the leadership of the First Nations Health Authority and figures like Dr. Janet Smiley and Dr. Lisa Richardson. And it's often confused with two adjacent concepts. Cultural awareness is the recognition that different cultures exist and have different practices. Cultural competence is the development of specific skills to work across cultural differences. Both are useful starting points. Cultural safety goes further.
How?
It locates the source of unsafe care not in cultural differences themselves, but in power asymmetries between providers and recipients. And it requires structural change to address those asymmetries. Critically, in cultural safety, the recipient of care, not the provider, judges whether the encounter was culturally safe. The provider does not get to grant themselves a cultural safety credential.
That's the move that's really hard for institutions.
And it's the move that matters. A health service can be culturally safe only if its governance, staffing, decision-making, and accountability are structured to be safe from the perspective of the people it serves. Surface-level changes, cultural artifacts in waiting rooms, occasional training sessions, don't produce cultural safety if underlying power relations are unchanged. The FNHA is in part a structural attempt to embed cultural safety in governance.
And the TRC calls to action 23 and 24 address this directly.
Call 24 specifies that medical and nursing schools require all students to take a course in Indigenous health, including content on cultural safety, the history and legacy of residential schools, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and Indigenous teachings and practices. Canadian health professions training is in the middle of implementing this, unevenly, with substantial variation across institutions. You may experience it directly in your own coursework.
A point the module makes that I want to underline. Pluralistic frameworks are not just about cultural respect. They're scientifically generative.
Yeah, this is the key methodological argument. The protective health effects of land-based programming for Indigenous youth wouldn't have been a research priority in a strictly biomedical frame. The work of Michael Chandler and Christopher Lalonde, no relation to Mark, showing that BC First Nations communities with stronger cultural continuity have markedly lower youth suicide rates, that came out of a research question framed by Indigenous worldviews, the role of language reclamation in adult mental health, the role of traditional food sovereignty in metabolic health, the role of ceremony in trauma recovery. All of those are research programs whose framing came from outside the Western canon.
And the methodological challenge those pose to mainstream public health is real.
Why is evidence from a randomized controlled trial more privileged than evidence from generations of community knowledge? Why does the field accept that traditional medical knowledge in, say, Greek antiquity was real knowledge while treating Indigenous knowledge systems as folklore? Why do data sovereignty questions matter? And how should public health work with communities whose data has historically been extracted, mishandled, and used to justify ongoing colonization?
The lesson introduces OCAP here as the answer.
Ownership, control, access, and possession. developed by what's now the First Nations Information Governance Center in 1998 and refined since, the four principles for the governance of First Nations data. Ownership: a community collectively owns its cultural knowledge and data. Control: First Nations have the right to control all aspects of research that affects them. Access: they must have access to data about themselves. Possession: physical custody. We'll come back to OCAP many times in this course. For now, just know it's an operational research governance framework, not a cultural respect statement.
Let me try to pull this lesson together. 8 quick takeaways.
Go for it.
First, disease, illness, and sickness are technically distinct. Disease is biomedical. Illness is the lived experience. Sickness is the social role. They come apart often, and a careful health scientist reads which one is at stake.
Second, health itself comes in negative and positive definitions. The negative definition, absence of disease, is operationally easy but counterintuitive. The positive definition, WHO 1948 and its descendants, is intuitively richer but operationally hard. Huber's adaptive reframing tries to split the difference.
Third, there are at least 5 Western models of health, layered in time: humors, miasma, germ theory, biomedical, biopsychosocial / salutogenic. Each was provisional. Each shaped what got measured. The current model will be displaced too.
Fourth, miasma was wrong but worked. The sanitary revolution it justified delivered some of the largest population health gains in history. Mechanism wrong, policy right. That combination has shown up more than once in the history of public health.
Fifth, 4 foundational documents define the modern field. WHO 1948 defined health positively. Lalonde 1974 said healthcare is one determinant among several. Alma-Ata 1978 made primary healthcare central. The Ottawa Charter 1986 gave us 5 action areas that still organize practice.
Sixth, pluralism is not optional. Indigenous holistic frameworks, Te Wer, Tapawa, and cultural safety, are operational frameworks in use today. They generate testable predictions and they reshape research priorities. The First Nations Health Authority in BC is one structural implementation. The TRC calls to action mandate health professions training in this content.
Seventh, OCAP, ownership, control, access, possession, is the working framework for Indigenous data sovereignty in Canada, not cultural respect, operational governance.
And eighth, the reflex this lesson tries to build more than any single fact is the habit of asking which model someone is using when they make a claim about health. Reading the model is the first move. It's the move that distinguishes a careful practitioner from a careless one.
And the capstone for this course starts this week. Students pick a health topic they'll follow for the whole term, a health topic biography, a different lens on it each week.
Pick something specific enough to be tractable, broad enough to have multiple angles: tobacco use, type 2 diabetes, depression, asthma, back pain, autism, opioid use disorder. Write a 1-page brief, how it's defined biomedically, how people who live with it describe it, what models from this lesson reframe it. That's week one.
Next lesson, we move from concepts to history. The rise of public health as an institutional field and the surveillance systems that grew up alongside it, that's lesson two.
Read the module before class, work through the knowledge checks, bring the reflections that didn't resolve cleanly to the in-class session.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you in lesson two.
Take care of yourselves. See you in class.